Straight Talk with MJ. I'm your host, Michelle Jeanette. Thank you once again for joining me on this great January day of 2022. I have a special guest today, Mr. Todd McKinley. He is a 20-year veteran of the Army. And because I'm an Army brat, I love talking with Army veterans or military veterans and getting their perspective on issues regarding any military issues. So we discuss things like that today. And then always at the end of my podcast, I bring to you great American stories or a little bit of history about our American founding. And I love to bring that because I love the historical perspective of things. And you can follow me at straighttalkwithmj.net. That's where all my podcasts are, and see all my previous interviews with different people and different topics. But we're going to talk today with him, and he will give a little background of where he's coming from, and we discuss some issues that are facing our military members currently. And there's a lot going on with them. But thanks again for joining me. Putting links to his pages in the podcast episode. You can go and click on the links and follow him. He has a great podcast also, and he joins a couple other guys once a week on a radio show that you can listen to. They cover a wide variety of political topics also. And so he's a great person to follow and get interesting perspective from his military background. But let's take a listen to my conversation with Todd McKinley. And at the end, I'll have a little history. And then don't forget to click on the links to follow him and learn more about him and all the things at military. Okay. I have Todd McKinley with me today. And we met back, or we didn't meet, but I called you on the phone and did an interview with you back in 2020.
Right.
When you were thinking about running for, I think it was representative for the state, right?
Yeah, it was a state rep seat. And then, you know, had a lot of stuff going on. My mom passed away, and some people still urged me to run. And, you know, it wasn't feasible to you know, go ask people to knock doors and raise money. And especially with COVID just kicking off at the same time, I just decided the time wasn't right. So I pushed back, and of course, continued to travel with the Trump administration as a staff associate. So that's what I did during that time up until, you know, last year. Tomorrow would be 1 full year since President Trump's been out of office. So
yeah, so that's, you know, give a little background, because I'm raised an Army brat, so I'm proud Army brat. But
there you go.
23 years in the Army, and so I always have a propensity. I'd love to hear the military veteran or whatever aspect of what's going on in the current, you know, world that we live in.
Oh, absolutely.
So background of your military career and what you did.
Yeah. So 20 years in the Army, and you said your dad had retired in 95. I came in 96.
Okay.
I did 20 years and 29 days, retiring officially Halloween 2016. So a little bit more than 5 years ago, I've been officially out. Been involved in veteran service organizations ever since, and as a staff associate with the Trump administration over the past 4 years. But in the Army, I served in Europe. I've served in stateside. I've served in Iraq, Afghanistan. I served actually 6.5 years at the White House as well, White House Communications Agency, and got to get a good insight of what goes on in Washington, D.C., during that 6.5 years, having a lot of good connections within the political world, a lot of the appointees from the Bush-Cheney administration days. And I was there briefly for about 6 months into the Obama administration before I left to go to Iraq as a military advisor. Of course, it was an apolitical job. So it's part of the White House military office. Actually, I got my hat on right now, White House Communications Agency. So it's a military organization that falls in the White House military office. And the people that are there are not involved in politics. Of course, I love politics. And, you know, on the side, on my personal time, I did get involved in politics to a degree, especially made a lot of good friendships, if you will. So I kind of had a good insight of what goes on in Washington, D.C. and in the executive branch. And of course, with the members of Congress that I become friendly with and their staff as well. So go see a lot of stuff there.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So what was your I guess, most memorable moment?
I could tell you a lot of different scenarios, a lot of different things. You know, from just doing everyday work, from, you know, motorcading from Naval Observatory to the White House and back again, meeting the Queen on two occasions in 1 week, Queen of England, you know, things like that, meeting a lot of different heads of state, meeting multiple presidents, former presidents, and of course, current presidents, vice presidents, traveling on Marine Two, Air Force Two, Air Force One, Air Force Two, and so on. And just being able to be in those different motorcades, joint motorcades with presidents and vice presidents and around the country, and, you know, travel around the country and around the world supporting, you know, presidents and vice presidents was kind of interesting. And, you know, being like within feet of them, just chit chatting, you know, of course, in an official capacity. But at times, sometimes you just get into those personal conversations if they bring something up, and it's just kind of interesting to see those types of people that you see on TV that you think are, you know, far off individuals, that, and the next thing you know, you're in the same room having a conversation with them. It's kind of interesting.
So I remember, in high school, we were stationed at Fort Campbell, and I went to school there, and, it was close to Christmas, and at that time they would have like 6 month tours over in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia or something like that.
Right.
And a friend of mine in class, her dad was a chaplain and was over there, and they had a whole plane load of military service members coming back. And I remember they had a scheduled time to go to the hangar to meet them as they kind of, you know, got off the plane.
Right.
They landed in Greenland. And then as they took off, something happened with the plane and the plane crashed.
Oh, and wow.
Two of them died. Like 200 of them died. And I remember, you know, they went to meet their family, but they got notice at the hangar that they didn't, because it was a short trip from there, from Greenland.
Right.
So I remember Reagan coming and mm-hmm. coming very quickly to meet with the family members and just really consoling them. Did you see any, when you were with presidents, did you see how they interacted with military? Can you tell the difference? Somebody who really, you know, appreciates them and values them, and the truth about, maybe for instance, like Trump, they always thought he didn't like the military or treated them bad.
Yeah, but yeah, definitely not true. You know, I saw Bush and I saw Cheney up close and personal, interact with the military on a regular basis. And, you know, to me, you know, Cheney was more of a technical guy whenever it came to the military, because he had been Secretary of Defense under Bush 41 during the first Gulf War.
Right.
So he was more of a technical guy. But he never treated anybody with disrespect. I mean, he would, you know, joke with you and talk with you and, you know, have a chat with you. But he was never like the backslapper like Bush was. Bush was more of a politician slash, you know, kind of a genuine type person, if you will, whenever you had discussions with people. Cheney was never really that personable type person, if you will, but he wasn't rude to anybody, if you will.
Right.
I mean, he had that more of a, I guess they made a caricatures of him, if you will, through the, you know, the media made fun of him, if you will, the movie Vice or whatever, they made kind of fun of him, if you will, but he's just more of a technical type person. But he was always, you know, very nice and very cordial to people. You know, he just had that mannerisms, if you will, that was more of a technical type person. And Biden, if you will, he was a politician through and through, a backslapper. You know, he never turned it off. I remember we flew to Chile for a summit down there, and we landed in Costa Rica to refuel. And he comes to the back of Air Force Two, and he's just shaking everybody's hand, backslapping and all this stuff. And I said, yeah, you know, sorry. You don't have to do that anymore. I said, you guys won the election. I was just kind of being funny with him.
Yeah.
He's like, yeah, you know, I've been doing this for, at that point, he said 30 some, nearly 40 some years, whatever it was at the time. He's like, I don't know how to turn it off. He said, this is just the way I am all the time. And he's like, I just don't know how to turn it off. He's like, this is the way it is. And I guess he's just been that way since he was in his 20s, you know, running for office at the local level, and then running for the U.S. Senate all those years. And then he ran for president a number of times as well.
Right.
And of course, Obama, he was one of those just, I saw him very little, but, you know, he was one of those guys that would talk to people and knew how to just chit chat with anybody. But he was also, at the same time, you could tell he didn't really know how to be around the military, if you will, because, you know, it was something that was kind of new to him, very kind of awkward to a degree. But at the same time, you know, I was only there for such a short period of time. I didn't interact with them that often. But I will tell you that having some interactions with Hillary Clinton and of course talking with her Secret Service and stuff, and she was a very nasty person toward the military. I know people that were stationed at this agency back whenever Bill Clinton was president, and they told me a lot of horror stories. And I got to witness that when she was Secretary of State up close and personal on a couple of occasions. And just the way she had disdain for military members. And you know, she let it be known. And I could tell that story, you know, but it would take up your entire podcast. But just a horrible human being whenever it came to treating people. Yeah.
And that kind of, I mean, after Trump, I mean, I know
Yeah, and I can tell you, having traveled, you know, around the country with President Trump and around the country, around the world with Vice President Pence, you know, they were very genuine with the military. I mean, President Trump, whenever he, you know, talked about, you know, on stage, whenever he'd give a speech, if you will, he was putting on a show, if you will, for people. But at the same time, whenever he talked about his love for the military, I saw it up close and personal, you know, at different functions, and you could tell that it was genuine. You know, like Don Jr., Eric Trump, and you know, Ivanka, and you saw them interact with people in the military, and they were just genuine good people. They weren't putting on airs, they weren't rude to anybody, they never spoke down anybody. And here are people that grew up, you know, with a silver spoon, if you will, in their mouth, that never acted that way. And I've had so many interactions with them. I've saw them interact with many members of the military, and they were just as nice as could be. And you could tell it come from a true place, in my opinion. So.
Well, that kind of switched, obviously, in the article I sent you. Let me see,
Right.
figure out how to do this here.
Yeah, and it's the guy named Bishop Garrison, and I know some people who, whenever his name came up some time ago, this is back, I guess last year, whenever Biden usurped, if you will, I call him the usurper in chief. I don't call him the commander in chief, but whenever he snuck into office there, and you saw Fox News report about this guy, and I know people who served at the Pentagon and people that worked at DHS who had interactions with this guy. Who were career officials, and of course this guy had been in the military once upon a time, you know, so I won't take that away from him, but I could talk about that and how the military is changing. But this guy right here is somebody who is on a mission. You know, whenever he was at DHS, whenever he was at the White House, whenever he was at DOD, and now that he's back at DOD, he has a set mission. It's an ideological mission to purge whatever agency or entity he's working with. And yeah, you got the article up right there. Yeah, so he has a mindset, and if you read his bio and you look at the organizations he's worked with, this is basically his MO is to go out and look for things and or create issues, if you will, or and go after people to try to purge society and purge these different agencies and departments of people that think differently than he does or think differently than the left, if you will. And this is what he's all about.
And I was reading in here about his some of his tweets.
Right. Yeah. No, those are probably some of the nicer tweets there.
The ones they could print in
Right.
Revolver. This is from Revolver.news. And down here, it says he's a proponent, a very strong proponent of the 1619 project.
Right.
And how, of course, if people aren't familiar with that, it really just distorts and pretty much falsifies the beginnings and how our country was established and born, if you will. And really, I like how he talks about the point, of course, is that it defines America as a nation built not on lofty ideals of freedom and self-government laid out in the document written by the founding fathers, but as one built on the degradation, dehumanization, and persecution of Black people. And of course, we know that's not true. Of how it was started, how our nation was formed. So we have that kind of radical thinker
Right.
in charge of diversity, equity, inclusion, and purging of quote unquote extremism in the military. And when you
Right.
look at the definition, it's pretty scary of how they de define extremism.
Right. Well, it's anybody who has a even a quasi conservative or libertarian ideology, ideology. Even if you believe in the true meaning of the Constitution, you could be considered an extremist if you wear like a 1776 shirt or a shirt that has a patriot with a Kentucky long rifle on it. That could be considered an extremist T-shirt now in the military, and they could come after you for that. And it's just a patriotic shirt. I mean, if you look at the National Guard Bureau, if you will, they have a Minuteman with a long rifle. But if you had a shirt on that had something like that and said 1776 or something like that, they could look at that and say, well, that's an extremist shirt, based on what the new statutes and the new regulations that are coming out in the military are basically state. So they could interpret it any way they wanted to. Now they don't really go after the left in their new definitions, if you will. If you look at it, it's the patriotic type people. It's the people who were, love our country, who joined the military because they had that genuine feel of what it's about to be American versus the new wokeness that they're pushing in the nation's military.
Yeah, and I also noticed in there when I looked up the whole immediate counter extreme. I think this is it. No,
Right.
it was talking about religious extremism, and they labeled it as, I took a picture of that one. The core belief, any ideology espousing the supremacy of a particular religion that advocates the establishment of religious purity through the subjugation, forced conversion, or elimination of other religions. And then they go on and say Christian extremism is often conflated with white supremacy. So they're pairing the two. No mention of radical, at least not under religious extremism.
What we've been fighting since,
Yeah.
9/11, 2001, and before that, radical Islamic terrorism.
Right.
Absolutely, yeah. And there's no, I could tell you, that there aren't extremist elements in the military. Now, back in, I think, the 90s, maybe the 80s, at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, there was a white supremacist elements that were there, but they purged them out really quickly. And I'm using purge in the sense that they use the Uniform Code of Military Justice to get them out of the military. Which we can't, you shouldn't have extremist elements within the military, especially practicing their beliefs within the military. There's no place for that, obviously. Whether it's some sort of right-wing extremist or left-wing extremist, we should be all Americans. We're there to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And what they're doing here is making people within the military enemies, so therefore they could purge them out of the military and push their ideology within the military. Because if you look at the military, for the most part, it's people that believe in the Constitution, believe in this country, that believe in the rule of law, that believe that believe in Americans, if you will, believe in the citizens of this country should have a vote, should have a say, and that we're defending them and their rights. And what they want to do, they want to push their own ideology. And how do you do that? Is to be able to get the military out of the way, because the military, for the most part, wouldn't go along with the left-wing ideology, with the flawed, destructive, evil ideology that is socialism, that is communism.
Right.
So what do you do? Well, you have to purge the military in steps. So this gentleman that we talked about there, he had graduated from the military academy. So just like they did in universities and in schools and teachers unions, they started putting people that were left-wing ideologues in our military academies. So that way, whenever they became officers, they could promote them through the ranks. It was a lot easier step versus trying to take somebody that's already established in the military and trying to get them to shift their thought process, toward the left, which is, would be hard to do because these people are already adults, are already well on their way in a career. So you train them from the get-go to think a certain way, and that way you have them from day one.
Well, and their definition of extremism back after Biden was installed,
Right.
the Secretary Austin ordered that stand down to purge extremism, but they never really labeled it, it defined exactly what that was. But of
Right.
course, we knew what it meant. And so since then, they've gone through all this whole process, and of course, I'm going to talk about later the whole readiness thing. But the my have family members who are in the Navy, young niece, and now they have added in the AP. They came out with an article. Just I don't know if it was it was dated just January, that they're at the Navy is adding 2 weeks to boot camp in a major overhaul aimed at improving recruits' war fighting and emergency skills, but that's not what they're being taught. They're not being right. taught war fighting or emergency skills.
No,
they're
no.
being taught character issues such as hazing and extremism and sexual assaults. In the
right. So, and what and other things that they're doing is teaching them to basically go. And I know a lot of younger folks that are in the military. I know some junior. Well, they were junior when I was in the military. Now they're now senior non-commissioned officers, and some of them are now field grade officers. And they're talking about some of the things that are coming down. A lot of these people are starting to move on from the military and retiring because they don't want to be a part of it, and which is what the left wants. Right. Is the ideology, if you will, of the left. And at the same time, they're talking about, you know, telling on your friends, telling on your battle buddies, if you will, if they believe something that's outside of the norm, that they define outside of the norm. So if you're one of those guys that believes in the Constitution, you talk about the Constitution, or you talk about America and you talk about God, guns, and all this stuff, well, you're an extremist to them. You're a threat to them. Now, they're teaching them to go tell on them with through their command. And then they get counseled. And the next thing you know, after a couple of counseling statements, they can give them an Article 15, or they can chapter them out of the military and be rid of them. And it's no different than any number of people that was served in our military for the past, you know, hundreds of years, you know, just good people that, right. Just good people that have fought for our country. And now it's about the ideology, because, you know, what would stand in the way of Democrats taking complete control of this country, or the left complete control? You know, they're already talking about federalizing our elections, which, you know, is a way to rig elections. Right. And what element in this country could stand up to that? What would be the military that could stand up to it? Now, if you can control the military fully, now you have nobody that can or will stand up to it.
And the ideology that that they're training these kids.
Right.
Which I always thought was kind of, I don't know, ironic that you're taking an oath to a constitution that they're teaching you to hate. And I don't understand. If you're taking an oath to this constitution, but you're taught to hate it, how is that reconciled?
Right. Well, it's a warped interpretation of what the constitution actually says. Yeah. It's not actually what it says verbatim. It's their own interpretation of it. Because to them, it's a living, breathing document that's always changing, that always has new meaning depending on the context or depending on the times you find yourself, which, you know, think about it, the right to keep and bear arms. Well, they think that the government has the right to determine what kind of arms you can have or whether you can have arms at all. Right. You know, that's what they believe. And they believe that the militia is what they determine it to be, which is the military, if you will, mm-hmm. as they define it.
Yeah. So
right. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Yes. So, yeah. So if they can define what all that is, you know, they can control society a lot easier. And I'll point to the fact that a lot of people on the right, you know, say this on a regular basis. Well, I don't like politics, or politics don't affect me, or I don't like politicians. They're all liars, or this and that, or they don't register to vote because they're like, well, I don't want to get jury duty, or I don't want to get, you know, involved in this. So they'll abdicate their role as a citizen, which is to vote, which is to get out bad people. And here's another thing. This, you have a lot of Republicans that'll say, you know, give us the majority, we're going to fight this and do all this stuff. It's like giving the same people that have been in power for decades, you know, the majority again. You know, we're fooling ourselves if we think they're going to do anything about it. This has come about, you know, because of them, you know, right under their noses. Because it's, as we say on the Common Sense Conservatives, our radio show, which is every Wednesday night, 7 o'clock. I don't know if you watch that. We call it the Uniparty, if you will, in Washington, D.C., because there's very few people in Washington, D.C. that are Republicans, that are true conservatives, that are about the Constitution, about this country, about fighting back. You know, a lot of times it's the same people. It's about the moneyed individuals. It's about the establishment within our party. Yes. And that's it. So it's you know, you may have the majority for a couple of years and they squander it. They do nothing about it. And all of this has come about. This extremist from the left has come about. Because Republicans, not all, but a great many Republicans, especially the establishment, has done nothing to truly fight back against it.
Yeah. And unfortunately, there's a couple in Congress that I thought were kind of really true conservatives, military members, former military members that have come out and are totally exposing themselves to who they really are. Won't mention some names, but
Right.
Dan is his first name. I don't know.
Right.
You know, and I would just, it was kind of disappointing to have, you know, because people were confronting him at a town hall and he was not doing so well.
Right.
So how is all of this? And now you have not just the Afghanistan debacle, which totally, not only killed people, but demoralized them even more, the military. So it started as soon as, you know, Biden took office, and then you know, with Austin, and then you have the horrible pullout in Afghanistan, and then the people died, and then the morale, you know, it's snowballing. What have you heard from your friends on that issue?
Right. Well, a lot of them have been retiring. And at the same time, the ones that are still in or that wants to stay in, now it's all this retraining that they're doing. It's woke classes that they have to do. They're wanting them to do, oh, let's just take our oath again and let's think about what our oath actually means. And they're trying to reinterpret their oath, which you take the oath one time, and unless you reenlist, you take it again. But the thing is, you shouldn't have to continue to take the oath, and reinterpret it. And let's think about what it means. You know what it means. The oath says what it says, just like the Constitution. And so they want to try to do all this woke stuff. Whenever they define extremism, if you will, or racism, it's always one way. It's just white people that are racist holding, minorities down or holding religious minorities down. It's Christians in the military holding, Muslims down, or people who hold some other sort of religion down, which is nonsense. They use EO culture, if you will, equal opportunity, to basically cultivate certain people and promote the wrong people. They're promoting people based on skin color, based on race, versus can the person do the job? And I've seen that during my time in the military a lot of times too. And now it's on steroids, as they say. They're promoting definitely the wrong people to the senior ranks, to field grade officers and so on, and especially to become a general officer. And if you listen to General Don Bolduc, who's running for Senate in New Hampshire, he talks about how definitely politicized it is to become a flag officer, which is a general officer or admiral. I mean, you definitely have to play the game. From the time you're a young officer all the way up, and which a lot of times you get not the best officers that become flag officers. It's the people that are played politics their entire career,
Which,
which that's not what we want.
no, and we've seen examples of that with Austin and Milley.
Right. And here, General Milley, for example, here's a guy who's a special forces special operator, and I think you may have even been in Delta Force, and I respected the guy. But then all of a sudden, he's one of those chameleons who wants to stay where he's at and in power and doesn't want to be ousted for, and gave in to this left woke culture, which kind of surprised me that he would say that in at a Senate hearing. Well, he wants to know more about this and that. It's like,
White
what are you talking about? Who are you pandering to?
fragility or
And
something.
to me, he was pandering just to keep the job.
Yeah, and I think as more information comes out, this is just a side note about his conversations. I think it was him, conversations with Pelosi
Right. Yeah.
January last year. I mean, how can you go around the commander in chief?
Right.
Is that not, was that not wrong?
Absolutely insubordinate. Exactly what that was. I mean, he had no reason to talk to her in any way whatsoever, unless he was speaking to her at maybe a social function, something like that. Yeah, yes, that you speak to somebody like that. But in an official capacity, he had no reason to be speaking to the Speaker of the House at all, period.
Right.
Unless there was a continuity of government crisis where, the president had been incapacitated, the vice president was, out of the way. But then you still have a series of cabinet secretaries just before you even, get to that point.
Right.
But well, actually, she's third in line. But let's say the president's incapacitated, vice president's incapacitated. Then at that point, you should be talking to her. But on a normal course of business, you should never be talking to her or anybody in the Senate for that matter.
Right. Especially with what they talked about,
Yeah,
the nuclear.
right. Absolutely. And he was undermining the president. There's one president and one commander in chief at the time. And that's it. Whether you like the person or not, whether you like his personality or not, I mean, I could say President Trump is abrasive, depending on your personality. Yeah, he is abrasive, but he's not the standard old politician, and we didn't want that. We needed to get away from that. Yeah. And of course, he upset the apple cart in Washington, D.C., which is good. And he exposed a lot of people, you know. But here's another thing. People talk about, well, President Trump's going to drain the swamp. It's like President Trump's not going to be able to drain the swamp by himself. He needs everybody to get behind him to help drain that swamp. And the thing is, people rested on their laurels that they got him elected and allowed the establishment to remain in control in the party versus pushing them out as well. Yeah. Pushing people out of Congress, pushing people out of the House and Senate, electing new people. We didn't do that. That's the problem. And thinking that he was going to drain the swamp on his own, you know, we were fooling ourselves for those people who thought that.
Well, and a good example would have been like the new AG in Virginia. He came in and fired about 30 people in the
right
in the office there, try to clean that out. That's
absolutely good deal.
You know, what we should be doing in every state.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
So, we talk about the readiness, and that kind of leads that snowball, you know, from last year to the Afghanistan. Now we have to talk about the elephant that everybody hates is the shots, right? And
right, vaccine, right.
Military. And I know I talked to my dad. He's like, well, we always just said, you know, put your arm out, you're given whatever you're given. And I understand that. I mean, you have to, you know, when you're in the military, you do what they say, you give up your individual, a lot of your individuality is to become a fighting machine.
Sure. But the vaccines that you're going to be given in the military have been tested, are tried and true vaccines. They're not, and they're also, you know, have been, you know, tested through the CDC, the FDA, Food and Drug Administration, all this stuff. They've been approved.
Right.
What we have now is just experimental stuff.
Yep.
So why would you give that to your military that you need to be strong? Why would you give that to them? Not really sure if it's really going to work or not, and how effective it's going to be. And what are the side effects at some point? What all the people you're giving a shot now, what if, you know, 1 to 2 years down the road, all of a sudden it's going to cause all kinds of disease, this and that. And now your military is completely incapacitated and vulnerable.
Well, and yes. And my thought too on that is, we know where this came from.
Sure, absolutely.
Enemy, right?
Yeah.
Whether it was a purpose or not, it doesn't matter. But, so the whole protocols of how to treat it or how to respond to it also came from our enemy, the China, the lockdowns, these forced vaccinations on something that's, like you said, it's not been tested. They're not even given religious exemptions, which is unheard of, to just blanket it. And before they even asked, you know, there was some emails or some calls that were, you know, came out that said, we are not giving them, you know, if they can ask, but it's not going to happen.
Right.
And so, you know, their religious freedom is being squashed at that point. And they're not allowed to report adverse events. So we don't know, you know,
right.
They're not keeping track of who this is harming, these shots.
Right.
I did hear of one Navy surgeon suggest, or really not just suggest, she just is imploring them to ground the pilots that have been vaccinated because of the possibility of heart attack or clots while they're flying.
Right.
That to me would be harming readiness more than just COVID itself, which being the most physically in shape military, you know, it's going to affect them, but it won't be as bad as the elderly. So how have you talked with people about this? Is that another notch in the thing of that's why I'm getting out, that kind of thing?
For some people, yeah, that is part of it. But most of them, they were already at that retirement age anyway. So they're like, well, I'm just going to drop my paperwork and I'm going to go and move on. I'm not going to deal with all this nonsense. I'd rather get my pension and be wash my hands of this. But a lot of times it's people that are could still be in the military for the next several years. Yeah. And you're losing a good leader, a good officer, a good NCO, or a good junior soldier who could be a good leader down the road, that are just saying, you know what, I'm not re-enlisted, I'm not going to deal with it, you know, to heck with it. So we're losing a lot of good people that are trained, that have been in the military, they have experience in combat. So we're losing a lot of that because they're not going to deal with this. They said enough of it. You know, we've already been jerked around with it by our country for and our military for years, you know, deployment after deployment. I'm not going to deal with this now. You know, I'm not dealing with the woke nonsense, especially with something that, you know, has not been truly tested, if it will. And we don't know what's in it.
Right.
And we have to, it's 75 years until we can actually know what's in this stuff. And we don't know the true side effects, the long-term effects. So why would we want to give it to our military? You know, these are people that are generally fairly young, if you will, 20s and 30s somethings, if you will. And of course, some of your older officers, if you will, some of the older NCOs, maybe in their 40s, you know, but they're healthy individuals. It's a fairly closed society in a lot of respects. They're not really people that have vulnerabilities. You don't have people with diabetes, you don't have people with heart disease, cancer, and all these other things that are, you know, the comorbidities. You don't really have that in the military. So even if some people do get COVID, you're finding, and you see this on the Navy ships, and you're seeing it in garrison where a lot of people are getting it. It may incapacitate them like a flu would for a couple of 2-3 days. And they're back up at it because these are people that are in shape. They run every day. You know, they eat right. Generally, they drink the right fluids. So it's not really having the effect like it's having on, say, elderly people or people with comorbidities out in society. So we're raising the alarm at the wrong place, I think.
Yeah. And you, especially when you see across the world, all these highly trained athletes that are dropping left and right.
That are getting the vaccine. Yes.
Yes. Cause they're getting the vaccine and
right.
They're, you know, forced into it. And you're thinking, okay, is that happening to our military? It seems like the people, I guess in soccer, because they're pushing themselves and pushing
right.
their heart rate, it comes out quicker. It shows it
sure.
quicker than just living a normal life.
Right. But in the military, you know, and there's a lot of people in the military that are out of shape to a degree. But for the most part, you have, if you compare, let's say, a 35-year-old military member to a 35-year-old civilian, for the most part, the military member is going to be in a lot better shape, a lot healthier, you know, because they're exercising more regular, they're running, they're, you know, doing things that people in a civilian world aren't generally doing on a daily basis. Even people that go to the gym on a regular basis aren't doing the same things that people in the military are doing. They're not as active. So you got somebody that's out there running every day, that's pushing their heart on a regular basis, you know, getting it above, you know, a fairly high heart rate, especially if you're running 4, 5, 6 miles every day. Yeah. And think about it. If that shot at the jab, if you will, is having an effect on the heart, you can imagine somebody running several miles every day, 3-4 times a week,
yeah.
what that's going to do to them. You know, so we should be careful before we just go around giving something that's not truly tested to our military, that we need to ensure that, you know, we can combat China, we combat Russia, and any other threat that we may face. So we need to be careful about it, I think.
Well, and I always thought that, like you said earlier, this is not an approved shot.
Right.
And they kind of tricked everybody with the wording, it's approved for Comirnaty, which is not available here in the U.S. So right. Really, we're still in the trial phase, and we're
all a part of that, right?
Yeah.
So now, I'm not saying that, you know, people shouldn't go get the shot. You should judge for yourself and consult your physician. But you shouldn't be forced to do something like this, especially in a situation where it's not been tried and true. Now, if it had been, you know, went through all the trials and it's already been approved, we know the long-term effects, you know, then I had no problem with you telling the military, you're going to get the shot. That's part of being in the military. I agree with that. Yeah. I've gotten shots before.
Sure.
But like I said, the ones we had were already approved, were tried and true, were tested. We knew what they were. We knew the effects of them.
Yeah.
So
how is that? Because, you know, they're pushing this so-called war in the Ukraine. And now we're, you know, all this stuff that we're training our military. Are we really ready to fight a war? Can we send our kids out the way they're getting trained right now? It seems to me they're not getting trained. For instance, in boot camp, the Navy boot camp, you get one day with at the gun range.
Right.
And, I mean, if you didn't grow up shooting guns, that would be your training at boot camp. And I don't maybe it's the Navy, I don't know if it's because of
yeah
thing.
I couldn't necessarily speak for Navy boot camp, but yeah. For the most part, Navy personnel aren't always, dealing with small arms like military, the Army would be, or Marines, if you will.
Right.
I mean, you know, everybody in the Army, Navy, Army, Marines, and so on, for the most part, have a small arms with them, which is an M4 rifle, M9 pistol, which is a 9mm, you know, something like that. You're going to, or they'll have a squad automatic weapon. You're going to deal with weapons that the Navy personnel probably aren't going to deal with in their career, for the most part, especially if they're on a ship.
Right. So I guess your overall assessment on what, you know, the military now versus when you were in.
Yeah. So I saw it progress from, you know, the time I joined the military through 20 plus years of how, you know, we promoted a lot of the wrong people. We got 9/11 happened. We focused on, you know, training to go to war. But, you know, after we went into, say, Afghanistan, we pretty much routed the Taliban within days. You know, there was no threat of losing there. But then the next thing you know, we had to go into Iraq. And next thing you know, we're nation building in all these places. And then we disband their military. We're fighting these asymmetric wars. An enemy that's not necessarily a force on force, if you will. We're kind of sitting ducks in situations like that, where they can lob indirect fire at us, set up roadside bombs, improvised explosive devices, things like that. Mm-hmm. Take us out one by one and demoralize us, but never defeat us. You know, they're not going to defeat our military or our nation, but we end up spinning ourselves into oblivion, thinking that we're going to transplant democracy to places like Afghanistan, which is a tribal, you know, mountainous, I don't say wasteland. It's beautiful, but it's tribal. It's very barren, if you will. You're not going to transplant westernized democracy, especially American style democracy, to Afghanistan and think it's going to work. And no matter how many billions of or trillions of dollars you throw at it, neither. And it's not going to work in Iraq either, or anywhere else in the Middle East. So instead of us going to places and just planning our military down and thinking we're going to nation build over the course of decades, and then, you know, whenever 20 years goes by and we say, well, it didn't work out. And next thing you know, we spent 20 some trillion dollars. It's like, you know, we wasted our time, we wasted our money, we spilt blood and treasure for no reason. It's like, let's go in and kick whoever we need to kick out of that country, which we did. And then maybe we stay for a short period of time, assist the people that are willing, but then we move out. Or maybe we maintain some sort of presence there, which, you know, we had Bagram Air Base. We could have maintained some presence in that country, versus staying there for 20 some years, spending money the way we did, and people getting killed ones and twos here and there. You know, we wasted time, wasted money, and we got nothing out of it. And you know,
because of the military industrial complex.
That's a part of it. And a lot of it has to do, yes, with Congress as well, because, you know, you think about all these different, like you said, the military industrial complex. Think about these companies. They have these political action committees, and they donate a lot of money to members of Congress, mm-hmm. and also members of Congress, House, Senate. They love having those contracts in their state and in their districts. That's jobs. That's money. So they love that. They have no problem with that. And at some point they're like, well, we got to use this up. So let's send the military somewhere. And then they wrap their arms around the military and around our veterans and say, oh, we love our military. We love our veterans. And mind you, you know, 90 some odd percent of Congress have never or will never serve. Their kids never served and will never serve, never will have to, because these are very wealthy people. And for the most part, they love the photo op with the military. But if you look at, say, the Republicans, and I've experienced this before, the establishment, especially not Republicans, mm-hmm. People, but the establishment within the party, they love saying the right thing, saying they love our military, they love our veterans. But in reality, they don't want military veterans to run for any office, because they know that they can't control us, because we are truly about the Constitution, about small government, about the, you know, putting the people's needs first versus party first, which means we wouldn't put their needs first, which is all their cronies that go along with that. Yeah. So that they despise people like myself if I want to run for office. And any veteran that's out there, for the most part, there's exceptions, but for the most part, would tell you that that's pretty much true.
Yeah. So on that note, you are running for office.
Yeah. Well, I've got to go turn my petition in today. It's the 6th District Sullivan County Commission. Looks like there'll be several people running. I'm not sure what it's going to look like come February, whenever the deadline is. But I want to get mine turned in today, because tomorrow I've got to go to Washington, D.C. for the weekend. So I'm going to get it turned in, and then that way I can start calling myself a candidate, if you will. You know, and do things as a candidate would do versus somebody that's thinking about running, if you will.
Right. And tell me again how people can follow you, because I know you have a podcast and you have the Common Sense, and I watched it with a couple of the other guys. That was pretty good talking to them.
Right.
Was it Idaho?
Yeah. Yeah, so yeah, we had a candidate on last week from Idaho. He's running for state house out there. But, you know, so it's Chris Wyatt. He's a retired Army colonel. He's out of Central PA. And, of course, we have John, who works in the booth up there in Nashua at the actual station. So it's a radio / podcast. So we're on a radio station, AM, FM, and it's also a podcast, Common Sense Conservatives. But people can check out my website. It's www.toddmckinley.com. And on there, you can go to media and you can go to the Todd McKinley commentary, or you can go to the Common Sense Conservatives. Okay. You can check out my articles, read up about me, and, you know, all kinds of good stuff there.
And it's McKinley.
Correct.
Okay. And so that Wyatt, that's funny. That's my dad. That's my maiden name, Wyatt.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's a good name.
But that's funny. I don't think they're related, though.
No.
From Tennessee. And what'd you say? Chris is from Pennsylvania.
Yeah. PA. Yeah. Well, he's from Ohio originally, but he's lives in PA. He taught at the War College up there, and that's where he retired at. So
that's pretty cool. All right. Well, I really appreciate your perspective on military issues. And I really thank you for coming in and talking with me about this. And we will get this out to people, and so they can listen and get the truth about the strain and the stress our military is under, this whole effort to purge them of true, you know, constitutional patriots, so to speak.
Yeah. And the type of people you really want to go fight for you versus people that aren't there for the right reasons. You know, they're talking about transgender policies and, you know, the military shouldn't be there to do all this social nonsense. Yeah. You should be there to fight in our nation's wars and win our nation's wars. And that's it.
Yeah.
So
you're supposed to be building fighting machines.
Right.
Well, thank you, Todd. I appreciate it.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm sure we'll talk again another time.
I hope so. Take care.
All right. Okay, so I hope you enjoyed that conversation. Maybe it brought some information to you that you didn't know before about what our military is going through. I hope, you know, we open our eyes to what is going on. I think a lot of us have. But now it's time for a little bit of history. And today I'm bringing you a story about the shot heard around the world. I'm getting this short story out of one of my favorite sources, the Founders Bible, and you can find that at wallbuilders.com. It's an excellent source. It's obviously the Bible, but it has so many stories and little tidbits of information about our founders and how it relates to certain scriptures and ideas and values that are in the Bible. But today's story is The Shot Heard Around the World, and it's about Pastor Jonas Clark and Lexington's Law of Liberty. April 19, 1775 marks the day of the first military engagement of the Revolutionary War, when 700 British Army regulars were sent to confiscate military supplies thought to be stored in the Massachusetts village of Concord, and to capture Patriot leaders Samuel Adams and John Hancock, who were reported to be staying in the village of Lexington. Previously, Paul Revere arranged for a signal to be sent by lantern from the steeple of the North Church in Boston, one if by land, two if by sea, to alert the countryside of any advance of British troops. On the night of April 18th, the colonists were signaled to the British mission, and the lantern's alarm sent Revere, William Doss, and other riders on the road to warn of the British column making its way toward Lexington. This day, April 19th, should be forever marked in the American mind as the day a few Americans stood their ground, refusing to surrender their God-given rights in the face of British tyranny. Yet, there is more to the story than retelling the drama of the 5 a.m. stand of 70 militiamen facing an overwhelming force of British infantry. Many of the militiamen were members of Pastor Jonas Clark's church. Clark stood close by on the road along with 40 to 100 spectators watching the events that morning as church member Captain John Parker, for whom the Minuteman statue was dedicated in 1900 at the 125th anniversary. He modeled the principles he had been taught from the scriptures. Captain John Parker of the Lexington Militia was a deacon in Pastor Clark's church. In addition to being a believer submitted to the Bible, his militia was under the Continental Congress. The Americans were not rebels, for the vast majority of those who resisted British tyranny had been taught the biblical doctrine of interposition by their pastors. Simply put, it meant the only lawful way to resist tyranny is to do so under duly constituted authority. They understood that direct resistance is rebellion and had been taught that only a defensive war in a just cause can be blessed by God. That is why Parker's orders, engraved on the Lexington Militia Line marker, are so significant. He said this, "Stand your ground. Don't fire unless fired upon, but if they mean to have a war, let it begin here." After Revere alerted Hancock and Adams at Pastor Clark's home that the British regulars were coming, Clark was asked, "Are your men ready?" He replied, "I have trained them for 20 years for this hour." He wasn't exaggerating. In 1755, Clark had been ordained a pastor in Lexington. He had drafted the instructions for the colony on resisting the Stamp Act of 1765, and had also drafted Lexington's boycott of English goods in 1774, giving clear instructions on the doctrine of interposition. Jonas Clark taught from the Bible that true liberty was a result of covenanting with God under the rule of law, God's law. When 16-year-old William Diamond beat his drum to bring the militia to the green around 1:30 a.m. on April 19, and then again around 4:30 a.m., he likely would have had 17-year-old Jonathan Harrington, the fifer, play the most famous hymn sung during the Revolution. The first words of the hymn, Chester, were significant. It said this, "Let tyrants shake their iron rod, let slavery clank her galling chains. We fear them not, we trust in God, New England's God forever reigns." In the pre-dawn light, as they lined up in formation on Lexington Green, the distant sound of marching feet and shouted orders alerted them of the redcoats' approach. As the British column emerged through the morning fog, the skirmish that was destined to birth a nation began. Captain Parker was 46 years old on April 19, but deathly ill with tuberculosis. In spite of this, after the initial conflict, he prepared his men to ambush the British at what is now known as Parker's Revenge, on their way back from Concord. In addition, he led detachments of his militia to Cambridge on May 6 through 10th and June 17 through 18 after the Battle of Bunker Hill before his death on September 17, 1775. Pastor Clark, who witnessed the entire event, countered British General Gage's report, quote, that the troops were fired upon by the rebels out of the meeting house and the neighboring houses as well as by those that were in the field, and that the troops only returned the fire, end quote. Clark simply stated this, "As to the question who fired first, if it can be a question with anyone, a cloud of witnesses whose veracity cannot be justly disputed upon oath have declared in the most expressive and positive terms that the British troops fired first." This agreed with his deacon, Captain Parker, who only 6 days after the battle stated in his legal deposition, quote, "I immediately ordered our militia to disperse and not to fire. Immediately said troops fired upon and killed 8 of our party without receiving any provocation thereof from us. Most of the 8 killed were shot in the back as they were obeying orders to disperse." Why is the shot that was heard around the world so important? It is important for Americans to remember that our war for independence was both lawful and just. It was a defensive war fought in a lawful manner, consistent with biblical principles. It was not a rebellion, nor was it lawless. Where did the many militia units get such teaching, and why would they adhere to such biblical principles? It was taught almost universally by the Black-Robed Regiment, the patriotic pastors who led the revolution behind the scenes, as well as taking up arms themselves. Who shot first was vitally important. True liberty based upon the rule of law was at stake. If we would support true liberty, both at home and abroad, we best begin in our churches with biblical explanations of why the law of liberty is what we want, not lawless democratic freedom that trades one form of tyranny for another. May God help us learn from our heritage. So what we're fighting against right now, obviously, is not something we started. We have the overreaching hand of the big government, big tech, big corporations, big pharma, and they are pushing this on people. All these mandates, these edicts, if you want to call it, that goes against every fiber of our Constitution and of God-given liberties and God-given freedoms. So we have to make sure we stand on the side of, like it says here, the law of liberty, so that when we do stand up against this, it is under a rule of law, not lawlessness. We've seen lawlessness in our streets in the summer of 2020 and beyond. So, you know, that's why I love bringing the true history of our great nation. You don't hear these things in school anymore, so that's why I bring it to you here. So if you want more of that kind of information, I definitely recommend the Founders Bible from wallbuilders.com. Fabulous, fabulous historical site to get lots of information from. Anyway, thanks for following me. Stay tuned for more episodes. And again, you can see all my previous episodes at straighttalkwithmj.net. And I'm also on Getter, G-E-T-T-R. It's an app similar to Twitter, but a lot more freedom to speak, and freedom of thought, and freedom of speaking. You don't get censored for believing truth. Anyway, thanks for following me, and we will talk again soon. God bless.